The US Treasury has designated in previous years many entities that are based in Dandong that have been active in illicit trade.
A border town is keeping a country alive. It's Tuesday, September 15th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Hollywood's tricky relationship with China, increased food needs, barbershops hope to trim COVID, viral college sports, and a uniquely designed nation's capital. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A new report shows how the Chinese border town of Dandong continues to provide a vital lifeline for the North Korean economy. That's despite United Nations sanctions that have been in place since Pyongyang conducted a nuclear missile test 3 years ago, an incident that many feared could have led to war on the Korean Peninsula. The report authors say businesses based in Dandong are trading in goods that could be used for Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs. Henry Ridgewell reports.
North Korea's gateway to the world. The Chinese city of Dandong sits across the Yalu River from the North Korean town of Sinuiju. The Friendship Bridge connects the two countries, while Dandong's financial infrastructure plays a crucial role in sustaining North Korean trade. Research from the Royal United Services Institute shows that between 2014 and 2017, almost a quarter of North Korea's total trade flowed through only 150 Dandong-based companies.
And that may include a lot of illicit trade. For example, the US Treasury has designated in previous years many entities that are based in Dandong that have been active in illicit trade.
Of these 150 companies, just 10 accounted for nearly two-thirds of all the reported trade during the period in question. Five of these firms have since been sanctioned by the US Treasury for their links to the North Korean government and its nuclear and missile programs. All are still actively trading. In 2017, when Pyongyang carried out its sixth and largest nuclear test, the United Nations Security Council imposed widespread sanctions on the North Korean economy, including exports of coal and minerals. Those sanctions were backed by China. But the report authors say there's strong evidence that the Dandong-based companies continue to import materials from North Korea.
Revenue generation through coal exports, that would then be funneled through front companies in Hong Kong that shared identifiers with Chinese companies, such as phone numbers and locations, and office locations. Some of these companies would send items to Syria, Iran, Myanmar, countries that have had previous previous reported military relationships with North Korea. And then those companies would then procure items and send them to North Korea.
That includes dual-use items banned under international sanctions, such as advanced machine tools.
There's a whole range of things, and it's difficult to say for certain what is for the nuclear program and ballistic missile program and what is not. In terms of illicit trade going on right now, it is hard to say because the trade figures have stopped being reported by China.
The report's authors say Dandong-based companies are enabling North Korea to evade sanctions, raising serious questions about China's implementation of measures that Beijing itself supported at the UN Security Council. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Afghan rivals talk peace as battlefield attacks continue. Landslides in Nepal kill 12 people, at least 21 missing. Slight easing of Australia's toughened COVID-19 lockdown. Japan's next prime minister, the self-made son of a farmer. Expectations lowered ahead of Europe-China summit. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. For years, U.S. businesses have been trying to get a piece of the huge Chinese market, and that's also true for Hollywood. However, as Disney is currently experiencing, doing business with China's authoritarian government can be tricky, especially in light of current political tensions between the United States and China. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
The pandemic is dealing a sickening blow to Hollywood. Theaters in key U.S. cities such as New York and Los Angeles remain shut.
With COVID, if the U.S. box office doesn't recover, the Chinese box office could overtake it this year.
China, the second largest movie market, is seeing a surge in ticket sales since movie theaters started reopening in July.
COVID has now made China even more important to Hollywood.
Chris Fenton, the former president of Motion Pictures for China-based DMG Entertainment, says even before the pandemic, Hollywood has been working hard for years to get into the Chinese market.
Hollywood said, you know what, we need to at least think about sensitive topics when it comes to China, for instance, Tiananmen Square or Taiwan or Tibet. So that at least has been a premeditated censorship by Hollywood starting in 1997. But the CCP's encroachment on fully operating inside the creative guidelines of what Hollywood does day to day has gotten more and more extensive over time.
But even with careful crafting of films, doing business in China has its perils.
She's both beautiful and strong.
Disney had high hopes for its movie Mulan. When Hollywood has been criticized for years for casting white actors to play Asian roles, Mulan has a predominantly Chinese cast, including actors Jet Li and Donnie Yen.
We wanted to make sure we had a full 100% Chinese cast, particularly because we've seen the backlash of films that have not followed that protocol.
The movie's release was delayed because of the pandemic. Now that the film is finally being streamed in the U.S. and released in Chinese theaters, there is controversy as viewers noticed some of the movie was filmed in Xinjiang, with credits thanking government entities there, where China is accused of human rights violations with mass detentions of the Muslim Uyghurs.
I think the issue is that we don't have visibility into why Xinjiang was chosen, and no one is willing to talk about it.
This comes after the Chinese-American actress who plays Mulan supported the Hong Kong police on social media last year during the mass demonstrations in Hong Kong against China's increasing control.
I think she is Mulan in the modern times.
From Thailand and South Korea to the U.S. and on social media, people have been calling for a boycott of Mulan. Disney has not responded for a request for a comment. Disney's troubles come at a time of political tensions between the U.S. and China. The New York Times reports the Trump administration is considering a ban on cotton products from Xinjiang. A Chinese spokesman says the U.S. is using human rights as an excuse to destabilize Xinjiang.
Xinjiang-related matters are not about rights, ethnicity, or religion, but about countering violence, terrorism, and separatism. The U.S. has no right or qualification to interfere.
In the midst of the Mulan backlash, Reuters reports Chinese authorities have told media outlets in China not to cover the release of Mulan in China. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Happening now in Asia, Yoshihide Suga was elected as the new head of Japan's ruling party on Monday, virtually guaranteeing him parliamentary election as the country's next prime minister. Shinzo Abe announced last month that he would resign due to health problems. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The economic impact of the coronavirus continues to linger in New York City, where lines to pick up donated food are still much longer than usual, according to a local charity group. Food Bank for New York City says it has distributed 30 million meals to New Yorkers. That's triple the number compared with last year. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
Food Bank for New York City says more people are showing up to receive food donations compared with the same time last year.
Year to date, we typically distribute about 10 million meals at this point, so we have already tripled that.
Janice Robinson, vice president of Food Bank for New York City, says she doesn't see an end in sight.
Sadly, New Yorkers are still struggling. People are unemployed and they're still having a need for food. Their children are being kept home, so those children aren't getting their meals at schools. So the need is only increasing.
Many in the line said they had been laid off because of the pandemic, and some said they were working but couldn't make ends meet without the help of donations.
It's a long line. But too many people, they need food. We don't have enough job. They lay off.
Some say costs also seem to be going up.
The kids are home. You're spending more money. It's like, come on. Then you have to buy equipment, you know, in order for them to be schooled properly at home. So you're spending more money and not receiving more money.
As people line up for food, the White House and Congress still haven't agreed on a second aid package. The last stimulus package provided $600 a week in supplemental unemployment payments, but that aid has expired in July.
I prefer working than have to be sitting there collecting a check every week, but, you know, it helped. But now that we're not getting nothing at all, I don't know how I'm going to pay my bills now.
Republicans and Democrats appeared to be deadlocked over a new stimulus package. The U.S. Senate on Thursday killed a $300 billion coronavirus aid package as Republicans and Democrats disagreed over the size and scope of the aid. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. A new Taiwanese maintenance center for F-16 fighter jets hopes to service the American-made aircraft belonging to multiple countries, a goal that experts say would outrage China and shake up Asian military diplomacy if realized. You'll find all these stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. This year marked the 100th anniversary of U.S. women being granted the right to vote through the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. The amendment was introduced in Congress in 1878, and it took more than 40 years to be passed and ratified by three-quarters of the states. VOA's Deborah Block looks at the history of the women's suffrage movement and women's equality today.
Feminists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries championed women's suffrage in the United States during a long and difficult struggle.
There's a lot of ridicule and scorn that's leveled at these women.
The fight for suffrage began in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention held in a church in Seneca Falls, New York. Delegates at the convention crafted a document that called for equality with men, including the right to vote.
They said all men and women are created equal. They borrowed from the Declaration of Independence, but they made that very significant change, adding "and women."
As women fought for suffrage for more than 70 years, black women were not welcomed into the movement by whites.
But in their own organizations, anti-slavery societies, church conferences, civil rights organizations, and more, African-American women over the course of two centuries developed their own women's movement.
As the roles of women were changing in the early 20th century, a new generation of women continued the struggle. They stepped up their protests, organizing parades, silent vigils, and hunger strikes.
They go out into crowds of men at factory gates at lunchtime and stand on little stools, and they give what are called stump speeches. They give speeches for women's suffrage in public to rowdy male audiences.
After President Woodrow Wilson changed his stance to support the amendment in 1918, it was ratified 2 years later. A century later, however, many women face voter suppression, especially those who are black.
disproportionately face voter ID requirements. They face polling places that are shuttered. They are purged disproportionately from the rolls.
Inequalities like these may be resolved through the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, proponents say, which was first introduced by suffragists in 1923.
You cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, and this would apply to the federal government and all of its policies and to the 50 states.
The future of the ERA is uncertain, but like the women who fought to vote, advocates say they will keep fighting for it. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
This is VOA Asia. African Americans are nearly four times more likely to die of COVID-19 than whites, by one estimate. But polls show more blacks than whites say they will not get a coronavirus vaccine when one becomes available. A history of racism in medicine means trust in the health system is lower among African Americans. To help overcome those barriers, health officials are turning to a respected institution in the black community, barbershops. VOA's Steve Barragona neatly trims our story.
I get all my education from the barbershop news.
Fred Spry owns a barbershop just north of Washington. He's close with his clients, he says.
Most everybody cuts friends and family. And if they were my friends and family, they became my friends and family after knowing.
That intimate relationship between barber and client has deep roots in African-American culture.
All this time throughout our history, black barbershops have been a place of refuge. They're like a sacred place.
What up, Fred?
Stephen Thomas heads the University of Maryland Center for Health Equity. He says that trusted relationship is an important one during the COVID-19 pandemic because trust in doctors is low in the black community.
For many African Americans, it's part of the oral tradition that you don't trust people in white coats who come into your neighborhood to say they want to help you.
Thomas says that tradition is rooted in centuries of racism, including unethical medical experiments involving blacks.
That's the zone of privacy.
Thomas says though African Americans are dying of COVID-19 at much higher rates than whites, they are also more skeptical about a vaccine.
If it was available tomorrow, would you take it?
No.
No? Everybody's waiting for a vaccine.
I mean, you want my honest answer, or you want me to give it the political answer?
I want your honest answer.
But Thomas has a plan to build confidence.
No food, anything in the past 30 minutes, right?
No, sir.
For one thing, he wants black barbershops to offer COVID tests. For more than a decade, Thomas has been turning black barbers and stylists into health advocates. They've been helping educate their clients about conditions like HIV, heart disease, and cancer, which minorities suffer at higher rates than whites. Studies show it works. Fred Spry says when one of his clients got screened for cancer, his doctor found a tumor and removed it.
It felt good because it was like I may have saved his life and it may have saved his family from having to mourn over him, you know, much earlier than they had to.
There you go.
Thomas is arming his network of barbers and stylists with COVID facts to combat misinformation. And with the coming influenza season threatening to make a bad situation worse, Thomas wants barbers to talk to their clients about flu shots.
We need to be working on that right now. The reasons why people are not taking the flu shot may be the same reasons they won't take a COVID vaccine when the time comes. Fear, mistrust.
That could change, he says, with a shave and a haircut and a word from someone they trust. Steve Barragona, Kensington, Maryland.
The coronavirus pandemic has caused colleges and universities in the United States to rethink how they will keep their students safe this fall. But in the case of sports, many institutions fear losing a significant portion of their revenue if games are canceled. Isha Sarai and Bart Vandiver have more.
Colleges and universities, many already under financial strain, could face additional funding hardships if they cut sports programs.
And, you know, there's never a good time for a pandemic, but for college sports, I think this was particularly bad because it happened right at the beginning of the men's basketball tournament. And the men's basketball tournament is the largest source of revenue for the NCAA.
According to figures from the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, college sports make roughly $1 billion annually in ticket sales and promotions for the universities. Athletic dollars from basketball, football, and baseball can contribute more than half of a school's operating budget.
That loss of revenue this year will be felt not just this year, but for the next several years to come.
Some of that money trickles down to students through financial aid. There are more than 20,000 international student athletes enrolled in competing NCAA schools. These schools provide more than $2.9 billion in athletic scholarships to students annually.
Prior to the pandemic, I was pretty confident that I would be able to get a scholarship with the improvements that I would have made during the season. But because of the ending of the season, that didn't happen. Hopefully, in the end, I'll be able to still get a scholarship and still be competitive at the college level.
Some schools are pushing to go ahead with their college football season, a move that will require a huge increase in COVID-19 testing for their athletes.
They don't necessarily have the right resources to do all the testing. So it's a concern because I don't know of a university football team that hasn't had positive cases.
But Thomas Hoard, who is working with colleges and universities to increase their testing capacity, understands the push to not cancel sports.
The economic impact to the universities is huge, as you can imagine. I think the budget for football is like $500 million for Texas. And so it's not a small feat. What do you do with season ticket holders? What do you do with, you know, people that have already bought tickets? Can you refund all that money or have you allocated it somewhere else already?
Whether schools will delay sports seasons or be forced to cancel them entirely is yet to play out. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia comes to you daily from Washington, D.C. And if you've ever visited here, have you wondered where Washington, D.C. gets its singular good looks? A commission made up of experts in the arts has a say about almost every public building, monument, and space in America's capital city. VOA's Dora McCauer explains.
Washington is a monumental city, a showcase capital with iconic views. And that's because most planned public projects go through the Commission of Fine Arts, a presidentially appointed panel established by Congress in 1910.
The idea was to really lift the image of the city as an important international capital and to really push that idea of dignity and beauty and all these things that really contribute to the image of the city.
The panel guides the architectural development of Washington and advises the federal government on matters related to the arts and national symbols, such as medals and coins. One of its most recent high-profile projects is the new White House fence, which is in the process of being installed.
Basically almost doubling the size of the fence and give it some kind of, you know, blast and ram protection. So everything, all the pieces had to be beefed up.
And look good while doing it. Since the 2001 terror attacks, security is front and center.
You try to make it not look so much like it's there, or find ways to make it feel like it's part of the visual environment. So it doesn't feel like you're going into a place that's really repellent. We actually work to try to make it still feel dignified and welcoming.
Pennsylvania Avenue used to be a busy main street in front of the White House. It was closed to traffic for security reasons in 1995. The Fine Arts Commission had a hand in making the secured area visually appealing. At the Lincoln Memorial, the reflecting pool serves as a security barrier, but visitors wouldn't know it. The same is true of the walkways leading to the Washington Monument.
It is perimeter security, but you don't really feel like it because it's actually a beautiful curving ramp that goes up to the monument itself.
Solar, storm drainage, and the urban landscape. These are some of the newest issues to come before the commission. The needs change over the decades, but the commission stays focused on maintaining a high-quality look so that the nation's capital never loses that special luster. In Washington, Dora McQuarrie, VOA News.
That's our program for today. Don't forget, we continue online on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube, all under the name VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us, and we thank our team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.